Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. With just a week to go until Election Day, you may be feeling an increased sense of anxiety, and that would be normal. But is it more intense than it has to be? Coming up on Insight this morning, we'll speak with an expert in this field who has some tips for maintaining your pre-election calm, if you can get that together. We'll also look at efforts to get out the Latino vote in California and why some say it is now more important than ever. And the race for mayor of Stockton with Cap Radio's Rich Ibarra, who explains what makes the candidates so unique. But first up, if you believe the polls, former Vice President Joe Biden will likely be the next president of the United States. Again, that's according to most major polls or a combination of polls from around the country. But we've heard this story before. In 2016, then candidate Donald Trump was supposed to lose to Hillary Clinton, who had a lead in the national polls. His win came as a shock for those who believed the pre-election polling was on target. So what are we supposed to believe this time around? Can we trust the polls, and why do they even matter? Have we learned anything from what happened 4 years ago? Amy Simon is a founding partner of Goodwin Simon Strategic Research, and she's here to help us understand all that. Her company specializes in polling, social and political marketing, and communications. And for transparency, we should let you know that Ms. Simon tells us that her firm is currently representing the Prop 24 campaign, so we'll steer clear of that one. But Amy, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Randall. It's great to be here.
So I am one of those poll geeks. I have to watch them constantly. And just recently, this morning, Doug Sovereign with KCBS Radio in San Francisco tweeted that a final Berkeley IGS survey on the presidential race here in California, Biden leads Trump by 36 points. If that margin holds up, Biden will win the state by the widest spread in 100 years. Is that something we can believe?
Yes, it is something you can believe. And what we're seeing nationally is that in more liberal states, that lead, that gap between Trump and Biden has been increasing and is significantly greater than it was in 2016 between Trump and Clinton. So that can lead to sort of a very high national number in terms of the gap when you're looking at national polling. So right now, Biden is in the aggregate, which 538 is a great, great website and podcast if folks really want to geek out on polling.
Right.
They aggregate all these different polls together. And so the national average right now is about 9 to 10 points.
Okay.
In terms of the gap.
Yeah. And 538 has Biden with an 88% chance of winning the election.
Yes.
What's different about the numbers in that 538 website? I realize it's an aggregate, but how is the polling being conducted or looked at differently this time around than it was 4 years ago? And I'm going to ask you, is your mic on your earphone cord? I'm going to just have you hold it up a little bit. I think it might be rubbing up against something on you.
Oh, great. I'll hold it right there.
Much better. Perfect.
Okay, great. I'll do that. So there's lots of differences. So first of all, in 2016, at this point in time, the national polls had Clinton up about 5 to 6 points over Trump. And now it's about 9 to 10 points. So that's a pretty significant difference. When you're down to like 2 to 3 points in terms of a national lead, then the race is still a toss up because that is not, the Electoral College doesn't track the popular vote in the way that we might expect it to. When you're at 5 to 6 points, then you're more likely to have the Electoral College match the popular vote in terms of the outcome. In 2016, there were two, I think, significant issues, maybe more, but there was a lot of national polling and a lot less state-specific polling in battleground states. So folks were not accurately tracking what was happening in terms of the Electoral College. They were overly reliant on national polls. In 2020, there's a lot less national polling reliance and a lot more focus on the specific battleground states. So that's giving more confidence that the polls are more likely to accurately reflect. We also learned as pollsters in 2016, not enough pollsters were considering the impact of non-college white voters compared to college-educated white voters. And that gap between them has been growing over the last several election cycles. So in 2016, a lot of pollsters were not weighting up non-college whites enough in terms of the polling sample.
When you say weighting up, what is weighting of the polls?
So polling, electoral polling is a combination of science and art. The science is that we need to know who is going to vote and make sure that we are polling a likely electorate sample. So we need to make sure we have the right proportion of men and women, people of different ages, people who are Black, Asian Pacific Islander, white, Hispanic, and that we also have an understanding about the geographic dispersal, who's very religious, who's less religious. We're looking at a lot of different demographic factors. Sometimes in polling, we underreach certain kinds of populations. And in 2016, we were either underreaching or underestimating how many non-college white people would show up. And that is obviously a core part of Trump's base. So some of those key state polls, the few that were there, weren't really reflecting what turned out to be a surge in non-college white votes. So this year, pollsters are really paying attention to that. So if they're not getting enough non-college white voters in their sample, they're weighting them up. They're giving them more weight in their poll to make sure they're adequately represented.
So in many of these states, if you factor in the error rate that we saw in 2016, Biden is still ahead in some of those swing states. And then when you consider that the polls are doing this weighting that they didn't do so much before, doesn't that even make the difference more significant?
Yes, it does seem that there can be a lot more confidence in the outcome this year based on the polling aggregate than in 2016. So one, pollsters are polling better in terms of how they're thinking about who's going to be in the likely electorate. Two, there's a lot more state-based, state-specific polling that people are able to look at. And three, there's so much, an unprecedented amount of early voting this year. All of these votes have already been cast. So those ballots are, you know, signed, sealed, and delivered. If there's some late-breaking thing that were to happen, and I'm not saying that there would be, but unlike in 2016 when you had that Comey letter break very late, and it was enabled a lot of late-breaking people to go against Clinton in terms of the folks who are undecided. Now, something like that is going to have a lot less impact because folks have already voted. And in addition, the undecided this year already was much smaller than it was in 2016. So there's fewer people to persuade.
Yeah, we're talking about that later in the show. We're talking about election anxiety. And I think some people have it right now because they're expecting this October surprise to still come. But as you just mentioned, with so many people already voting or in the process of voting, that surprise would have to come pretty quickly for it to make a difference, right?
That's right.
And how do pollsters and, like, you know, people associated with your firm, how are they working with the campaigns during this super unusual period where most of the voting is being done prior to Election Day? I imagine it's a different dynamic that you have.
There's lots of different dynamics. And as pollsters, it impacts, of course, how we ask our questions when we're tracking, because we want to make sure that we're accurately representing how many people have really voted in our polls already versus how many are anticipating voting. That's part of the art. And every polling firm has a different way of modeling who they think is going to be a likely voter and how to consider them. And so that is one of the reasons that you see differences between polls among different pollsters, because everybody has their own kind of secret formula where they're trying to decide who they think is most likely to be in the electorate based on a lot of other prior election results, exit polls, demographic trends and changes.
We talked a little bit earlier about trying to get a representative sample, and so you factor in that weighting because not everyone wants to answer a call from a pollster. I've never been called by a pollster. And so I've always sort of wondered, what's the opening sentence? Like, how do you keep people from hanging up right away? How do you get them to answer in the first place? Because I don't answer a number I don't know.
Certainly, that's certainly an issue. So first of all, when we are calling people on their phone, we call people on both cell phones and landlines at home these days. We've been calling people on cell phones for a long time now because that is the way to reach a lot of people. And so the opening line is typically, hello, this is not a sales call. This is a survey. It's confidential and anonymous. Love to take a moment of your time. And then people are often willing to listen for another minute. And then when they hear that it's legitimate questions, they're willing to stay on. There are a lot of folks who don't get to express their point of view very often, and they're actually really grateful to be able to say what they think about things. So we do capture points of view that way. And in addition, there's a lot more high quality online polling that's happening now than used to be the case. So a lot of people are willing to take surveys on their phones, on their smartphones, on their computers, on their iPads, et cetera, in ways that weren't possible even just, you know, 5 or 6 years ago.
You mentioned 538 as being a great source. Are there other polling firms that you have really high confidence in?
There's a lot, not so much firms as entities. So PPIC in California does very, you know, careful, thoughtful, accurate polling. They're very, very high quality in terms of their methodology. There are lots of national polls. You know, Wall Street Journal, NBC, and ABC do a lot of really careful polling. And one of the things that 538 has is they actually rate different pollsters on their website. So you can go and see if a pollster is rated A plus A, A minus C. So if you're curious about whether a particular poll is something that you should give weight to, you can go to the 538 website and look at the pollster rating and check it out and see what their track record is.
And we should mention 538 is written out. It's not the numbers. It's yes. F-I-V-E, et cetera. I looked at those ratings, and one of the polls, it was actually really similar to all the other ones, which surprised me, but it was SurveyMonkey, and they gave that like a D minus or something, but their numbers were similar. So there's that. So what do we know about California polling? I know that you've seen some recent data on a few of the propositions. Can you share that with us?
Yeah. So PPIC recently released a poll this week on Prop 15 and Prop 16. And so Prop 15 is the property tax poll, basically, that would do the split roll based on commercial and personal homes.
It's a partial rollback of Prop 13 from many, many years ago.
Yes, that's right. And that looks to be tight. So right now it's 49% yes and 45% no. So just a 4-point lead, 6% unsure. So we'll see. Mm. One of the things we know from polling right now is that early voters across the country, not just in California, are more likely to be Democrats, and election day voters are more likely to be Republicans. And so there's some unknown about how much of a surge in voter enthusiasm there'll be among Democrats and liberals compared to Republicans and conservatives. But that 4-point gap shows that it's more likely to pass, but also is close and certainly could go either way.
Mm-hmm. And which one is 16?
16 is the affirmative action to repeal the ban on affirmative action. And so that looks like it's going down to a loss. The PPIC poll shows it at 50% no, 37% yes, and then the rest unsure.
22 is the one that we are all being inundated with flyers or some sort of advertising, much of that paid for by the gig companies. What are we seeing there?
So some shifting in there, and as you've mentioned, there's a huge amount of spending happening on behalf of that from the gig companies. So right now, it's 46% yes in the most recent survey, and 42% no, with 12% undecided. So that is another poll, another ballot measure that could definitely go either way.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. How do the political campaigns use these polls? And how does the electorate change when they hear that something's ahead or behind? Does it affect people in how they choose to vote?
You know, that's a really interesting question. There are some cases where there is sort of a bandwagon effect. They hear that something is likely to lose. And so they're like, oh, if I was thinking about voting for that, but so many people are voting no, maybe I'm going to reconsider my vote and look into it a little bit more, get a little bit more information or talk to some more friends about it. And then the flip side, if I was inclined to vote against something and I hear it might be winning, then I say, oh, well, maybe I didn't look at that carefully enough and I'll take a fresh look at that. So there can be some kind of reconsideration effect that happens.
Mm-hmm. And the campaigns themselves, if they hear that their candidate or their issue is way ahead or way behind, how does that affect how they move forward?
So campaigns, of course, do their own polling. So they're not relying on public data. They're doing tracking polls to make sure that they know how they're doing as they go. Mm. And they're using the tracking polls to engage in more targeted communication. So if there's certain kinds of people that are more likely to be undecided, then they're going to really focus on a lot more communications to them, paid communications to them, to try to swing them to their area. They may also focus on targeted turnout to try to make sure that the people who are more likely to support them are definitely going to cast their ballot. So they'll do some ballot chasing where they'll really encourage those people to vote.
So Amy, boiling it all down, we can have a greater level of confidence in the polls we're seeing in 2020 than we did 4 years ago.
Yes, boiling it all down, certainly in terms of the presidential campaign, you can have more confidence than you did in 2016.
Amy Simon with Goodwin Simon Strategic Research. We really appreciate you taking the time to share your level of expertise with us this morning. It helps a lot.
Great. Thank you so much, Randall. Take care.
And just ahead on Insight, we'll dive into the race for mayor in Stockton and look into an effort to boost the Latino vote in California this year. Also, what is stressing you out the most about this election? We'll speak with a Stanford psychologist who specializes in election anxiety. Let us know what is bothering you. Insight at capradio.org. And you are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. One of the Central Valley's largest cities is Stockton, where Mayor Michael Tubbs is facing off against a newcomer, Kevin Lincoln. Both are men of color, Tubbs being African-American and Lincoln being half Mexican, half black. In the primary election, Mayor Tubbs was up against seven other candidates who were vying for his spot as mayor. He ended up securing his spot on the November ballot with 40% of the vote. We're focusing on this race because when Tubbs first became mayor at age 26, he made headlines, as you know, for being the youngest mayor California had ever seen, let alone for a city the size of Stockton. Here to tell us a bit more about the Stockton mayoral race and to give us details on the candidates is Cap Radio's contributing reporter, Rich Ibarra. Rich, welcome back to Insight. Nice to have you here.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
A nice spot on the zoo that you had at the top of the hour there. I enjoyed that as well. Okay, so Rich, with either candidate, we're looking at having another mayor who will be under the age of 40 and a person of color. What are people in the area saying about this?
I think most people look upon it as having a selection where there are two worthy candidates. Now, when Mayor Tubbs first ran for mayor 4 years ago, he was up against Silva, who was running for re-election, Anthony Silva. But Silva was plagued by scandals. He was also charged with crimes during that time in office. So his victory was really a landslide as far as for Tubbs. But this time we have two really worthy candidates. Both men are well-educated, both have good backgrounds, good family men. I think it's a real case where you have two really worthy candidates, but with slightly different agendas as far as in terms of what they would do as mayor.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about that. So we know a lot about Mayor Tubbs because, you know, he has initiated this basic income or universal income. We know about just, you know, several of his different things because he's been in the news so much. There's been a spotlight on him. He even had a documentary on HBO that we featured here on Insight. Tell us a little more about Kevin Lincoln and how he would like to see the city move forward.
Well, both Kevin Lincoln and Michael Tubbs are both Stockton natives. Kevin Lincoln, who's 39 years old, served in the Marines, was assigned to Marine One, which is the detail for the president's flight aboard his helicopter at the White House. That was under President George W. Bush. Lincoln is married with two children, has a master's degree in executive leadership. Lincoln was a district manager for a corporation after the Marines, but now is a full-time minister at a local church. Though the mayor's race is considered nonpartisan, Lincoln is endorsed by the local Republican Party. So there is a divide.
Right. There is a difference there. And Mayor Tubbs, which of the issues that he gets behind is he really pushing as he moves forward?
One of the things he's talking about is COVID-19 and the resources to, I suppose, help the community. He's done that by providing aid to businesses as well as aid to people who cannot pay their mortgage or cannot pay the rent. And so that city has come across with grants. Now, one thing that both candidates are really fervent about is homelessness. Now, let's take a listen to Kevin Lincoln first, and then we'll have Mayor Tubbs talk on that same subject.
Mm-hmm. It's in our backyards. It's when we exit the freeways. It's everywhere. And there's nothing more as a parent myself that I want for our community is that families be able to take their kids to the park again and not have to worry about are they going to pick up something they shouldn't pick up, are they going to step on something, you know, moving our city forward, experiencing and realizing the full potential that our city is capable of experiencing.
Well, I spent 2 years lobbying with the governor, and finally the city received this May $6 million to deal with homelessness, but also an additional $3 million to buy a hotel and convert it to permanent supportive housing. These are the biggest wins for homelessness the city has seen in a generation.
So how would you characterize the largest difference in their approach to homelessness?
Well, at this point, you know, Mayor Tubbs has something that he has accomplished. He's brought in trailers from the state to house the homeless. He's also, as you heard in that interview, that he has also bought basically a motel to house homeless people. In other words, this is supportive housing. Now, Kevin Lincoln has outlined a plan. In fact, he's posted it on his website as far as a step-by-step of what he plans to do. But at this point, too, he's resting on what he plans to do while Tubbs is touting his accomplishments. Now, another area of concern too is police reform, such as, you know, Black Lives Matter. But also in this case, both candidates have nothing but praise for the Stockton Police Department. In the fact that both candidates feel that the police department in our city has accomplished quite a bit, but they both feel there's still a lot to do in terms of reform. Let's hear first from Kevin Lincoln, and then we'll go to Michael Tubbs.
The city of Stockton, we haven't arrived, you know, to the place that we need to be. And there's a lot of work, you know, that still needs to be done. But it's time for Stockton to have a leader in their mayor that will bring people, you know, together and give everybody a seat at the table.
Under my leadership, we've seen that the Stockton Police Department has led the state in declining officer-involved shootings, that we are leading the nation in procedural justice and implicit bias, policing in the public's best interest. And that's why in Stockton, you didn't see the National Guard. You didn't see riots. You didn't see tear gas. You didn't see rubber bullets. That didn't just happen. That took leadership, and I'm proud of that work.
Is it surprising at all that both being candidates of color, that there's not any level of criticism regarding the Stockton Police Department?
I don't think that's so much. I think the Stockton Police Department, even in my estimation, has accomplished quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're talking about national recognition for the Stockton Police Department in terms of ties to the community. It's made great strides in the last 5 or 6 years. And I think that says a lot about the department and the leadership from the department that has come about. I think another thing too, though, is the fact that Stockton is the most diverse city probably in California in terms of minorities and the mix that we have here. Additionally, though, that hasn't always come as far as with certain bumps in the road. During a recent debate between the two candidates, which was hosted on Zoom by the League of Women Voters, there was an interruption by some people who were started calling hate things on both candidates based on race. Mm. So, you know, you do have that situation. But here's a look at how the candidates view as far as having two candidates of color running in the most diverse city in California. First from Lincoln and then from Mayor Tubbs.
I am biracial, so my mother is Mexican, and my father is Black, and so you know, I think it's great to have that represent, you know, at, you know, two candidates here in the runoff for mayor of Stockton that are candidates of color.
As the first African American mayor, it's not lost on me that without running and winning in 2016, there would be no Kevin Lincoln candidacy in 2020. But by breaking barriers and showing people that leadership can come from everywhere, we've even created opportunity for my opponent to run. So I'm incredibly proud of the city, and I'm incredibly proud of that work as well.
Rich, you've been in Stockton for so long, and you are just incredibly well-connected. What are you hearing from people regarding these candidates in terms of their abilities to lead the city going forward?
I think it depends upon which way the individual voter sees politics. In other words, the Democratic liberal, more liberal or maybe moderate, would maybe favor Tubbs. The more conservative voter would go towards Lincoln. He's endorsed also by the Stockton Police Union and also by the Firefighters Union. So Tubbs has a lot of others endorsing him from all around the Democratic side.
And Rich, as we talked about in the intro to your segment here, Tubbs was up against a really large field of candidates during the primary. I assume some of those candidates took away from his vote so that he ended up with 40%. Are some of those groups likely to then come over to his side here in the general election?
It's hard to say how it'll stack up. I mean, one thing with regards to Kevin Lincoln, he had about 24% of the vote. So it was a good showing, but obviously Tubbs was way ahead. But now that you have a two-candidate runoff, anything's possible.
Right, right. All right, Cap Radio's Rich Ibarra, always great to talk to you, and hope to have you on again soon.
See you soon.
So the electorate in California has evolved over the past few decades, with Latinos now making up a much larger percentage of registered voters. According to Pew Research, there are nearly 8 million eligible Latino voters in the state, making up nearly a third of the potential electorate. KQED's immigration reporter Farida Jabvala Romero joins us now to discuss the importance of California's Latino vote, and you likely hear her reporting often here on Cap Radio with the California Report, which airs during Morning Edition, and some other joint projects our stations have worked on together. So it's really nice to have you on Insight.
Thank you for having me, Randall.
Yeah. So, Farida, the Public Policy Institute of California says Latinos, Asian Americans, and African Americans are less likely to vote than whites. But you've reported on a push to increase the participation of Latinos this election. Who's behind these efforts?
Yes. So Latinos are now about a third of all eligible voters in California. So really, they could be a really important voting bloc if they use that political power. And there's a lot of civic engagement organizations, mostly, and other groups that are trying to engage Latino voters for this election, talk to them about the importance of their participation, and also the difference that races, especially local decisions they can take in the ballot, can affect their lives. Mm. So a big push right now before the election.
Yeah. And what are they doing specifically to get the Latino vote out?
Yes. So the gold standard, what we've seen in past elections and, you know, what political scientists have, based on the research that they've done, the best way to really, you know, invite Latino voters who may be unlikely voters or infrequent voters is to knock on doors and have a conversation with them about, you know, how the ballot impacts their life and issues that they care about. And of course, with the pandemic, those efforts have been hampered. You know, organizations have to pull back on those strategies, those tried and true voter outreach methods, or they've had to completely, you know, leave that aside and just focus on phone banking, texting, you know, social media, other types of efforts to reach Latino voters. Mm. And so, you know, we still have to see how that's going to pan out in the election and if it's really going to, you know, translate into a greater proportion of Latino voters in California who cast their ballots. So it's a big experiment right now.
Yeah, I guess in the end, we'll see whether phone banking is as effective as what you called the gold standard there. Some of the people you interviewed say it's important for them to vote so that they can have a voice for friends or relatives who can't. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, so I spoke to, you know, really first time super excited Latino voters in the state. And some of them told me that they, you know, they come from mixed immigration status families. So people in the same family will have different immigration status. You know, some of them are naturalized citizens, some of them are born in the US, and some of them are undocumented residents who, of course, can't vote. And so what I heard from young, you know, 18-year-old Latino voters who are in the situation where they have relatives who are undocumented, you know, they say they really want their voice to reflect and to, you know, like represent the interests of this huge part of our population here in California, and who oftentimes are an important part of our local economies as well, but who can't, you know, have a say in the election. So I think, you know, it's really interesting to see the responsibility that these young voters are taking on to not just represent their voice, but also those who can't, you know, vote this election because of their immigration status.
Farida, we are seeing an energy with this election that we haven't seen so much in earlier ones. Is that translating to turnout for Latino voters? Do we have any info there?
Yeah, so there's some really great data out there. Political Data Inc. Puts it together. It's like a ballot tracker. Since we have, you know, all of our registered voters in California are getting their mailed ballots. So a lot of people are returning those already. I just checked it this morning. About 1.4 million Latinos have returned their ballots already. That turns out to be about 24% of all the ballots that have been mailed to Latinos, about 5.8 million total. So there are really good signs of engagement and enthusiasm this election. But like we said, you know, we don't know yet exactly what that turnout is going to be. Latinos tend to vote in person. And so that's why, you know, experts and people who track, you know, the Latino vote say there's still a big push that needs to be made in these last few days before the election. That said, I've been talking to voters, especially here in the Bay Area, who say that, you know, they've already voted or they're for sure going to vote. And a lot of that, you know, is motivated by the economy, the situation we have with the pandemic, and to some extent, you know, the rhetoric that has come out of the White House with regards to Latinos and other ethnic minorities, and also on immigration issues. So I think we're expecting a really good turnout, but what exactly that's going to look like, we don't know yet. And, you know, for Latinos, it's really important to keep in mind, you know, this rhetoric we've heard about the sleeping giant and, you know, this, you know, huge power that's suddenly going to like wake up. Realistically, what's going to what we might see is that Latinos, you know, inch forward in the representation, political representation in the state. And what that would mean is, you know, if like half of all the eligible Latino voters cast ballots, that would be a huge, you know, step forward is what I've heard. But experts are not expecting Latinos to have the same political representation as white voters, as black voters who've, you know, been, you know, a lot more active in previous elections.
And we do know that a majority of Latino registered voters are Democrats, but it's not a given that they'll be Democrats, and actually at a lesser margin than of some other races.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's a huge, of course, when we speak about, you know, Latinos in general, I mean, it's just like a huge, diverse section of our population. Many of them have roots in, you know, several countries around the world. And, you know, depending on their situation in life, like all of us, you know, they have different preferences and different choices, different priorities. And so that's why, you know, it's really important to engage these voters. What experts, political scientists have told me is that political campaigns haven't, you know, they have, Latino voters haven't been typically their main focus because so many of them have been unlikely or infrequent voters. And when you're in a political campaign, you know, and you just care about winning and, you know, the difference might be just like a couple of votes. You know, you don't care if everyone votes. You just care about getting enough votes to win. So they'll put most of their emphasis on very reliable, likely voters, and most Latinos are not. So the work to really engage this huge, you know, group and big core of our of our voting, you know, people in the state is left to small nonprofits, you know, grassroots organizations who just don't have the resources that other, you know, big campaigns do. And of course, we know California is not a battleground state, so we're not getting a lot of the billions of dollars that are being spent in the election in battleground regions.
Finally, do analysts have any sense of where this increased Latino vote might make the most difference?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have, you know, the presidential race, of course, attracts a lot of people to the election. You know, it's like a huge issue. But in California, we have a couple of very competitive congressional races. And so that will decide the seats in the House of Representatives. And so one of those areas is District 21, the 21st Congressional District in the Central Valley. It incorporates part of Fresno, Tulare, you know, other counties in the Central Valley. Latinos are about 60% of eligible voters in that area.
60.
And so if we just get a 60, yeah, almost two-thirds. That's eligible voters. The Latino population is even greater. It's more like 70-something percent, you know, but not all of them can vote. And so if just a couple, you know, if there's a little bit more turnout for Latinos in those districts, it could have a huge impact on who wins the House of Representatives seat.
Right. Yeah. Wow. All right, KQED's immigration reporter, Farida Jabvala-Romero, thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us here on Insight this morning. It's nice to see you Zoom style face to face.
That's right. Well, thank you so much, Randall. It's great to be here.
All right. Still ahead, feeling stressed out because of the election? You are not alone. Surveys show roughly 7 in 10 of us are feeling a little freaked out. So what to do about it? How do you avoid triggers? We'll speak with an expert from Stanford University who has some answers for you. And what's causing you the most anxiety? Shoot us an email to insight@capradio.org. Again, insight@capradio.org. Or you can use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. We'd love to hear what's, I guess, getting under your skin right now. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Deep breath. Election day is exactly 1 week out. It's well documented at this point just how high the stakes are. Couple that with a rough election season and you get election anxiety or other feelings of mental distress with November 3rd nearly here. And there's some science to back it up, the anxiety the election is causing among Americans. According to a new survey out this month from the American Psychological Association, nearly 70%, so 7 in 10 of the respondents, said the elections are a significant source of stress. So the other three might have levels of stress still, just not significant. Joining us now to talk about it and how to cope before and after ballots are cast is Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University, Keith Humphreys. Welcome to Insight. Nice to have you here.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
and a quick Google search of your name, you're sort of the go-to guy on this topic.
Yeah, I've been asked about it a lot, which helps with my own anxiety because I'm talking out.
So election anxiety is a real thing, right?
Yeah, it's a perfectly rational thing. I mean, elections have enormous consequences for our lives, you know, the economy, politically, culturally, and yet we can't control it very much because 300 million people get input. So it's perfectly rational to feel anxious about really important things that we can't control.
Mm-hmm. What do you think it is about the elections that stresses us out? Is it the daily newscasts? Is it the polling that we talked about earlier in the show? Are there specific triggers that really get us going?
Yeah, the world has definitely changed with social media. And, you know, we can now obsessively check, you know, more than once a second if we want to, about how is the poll going on this? Is my candidate doing well? Is my candidate doing badly? What are left-handed Lithuanian immigrants up in Stockton doing? You know, all that kind of stuff. And that was not possible in the age of the printed newspaper, you know, and therefore it would be, out of mind. There might have been some polls, but they would come out really slowly. And so if that's what you're doing, it's a really good idea to stop doing it. Personally, I've taken to reading crime novels on paper away from my computer where I can't look at Twitter and I can't look at polls. And I recommend people do that. Read a book, get away from it. It's driving you crazy.
It's true. I took last week off, and for the first time in my life, I had an entire week off where I didn't go somewhere. I just stayed here, but I purposely chose to hide the phone, hide the iPad, and I didn't turn on the television except to, you know, binge watch some stuff on some of the different streaming services. And I completely took myself out of it. So yesterday when I was on the show, I actually felt like I wasn't as plugged in as I should have been just because I was so completely out of it. But that's a good idea to just like turn away. Don't look.
Yeah, I mean, actually, the evidence on social media in general is breaks from it are good for our mental health for lots of reasons. But certainly when what we're getting is, you know, continual fear. I mean, because also we're in the middle of a pandemic too. So, you know, you can look at that and then you can look at the election and then you lay awake at night just shaking and it doesn't do you any good. So taking those breaks, however, you know, the way you did, zone out, watch a movie, go for a walk is a really good idea. And, you know, it's not going to go away. It'll be there whenever you get back to it. So you can set it down.
You talk about doom scrolling and obsessing. Yeah. I guess that's part of what we're talking about, right?
Yeah, because your thing about anxiety in general is that, you know, why do people check whether their door is locked 100 times a day? People have obsessive compulsive disorder. Mm-hmm. It's every time they check it, they get a reward, a little relief. Oh, okay, it's locked. Oh, it's locked. It's locked. Well, you can do that with the internet as well. If you're sort of anxious, you know, okay, it's going well here. It's going here. So you're getting that psychological reward, which makes you want to repeat it and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. And as long as you're on there, you can pretty much do it forever. You could do that 24 hours a day. And, you know, even though you get those little hits of, oh, maybe this is going better or that's going a little worse. In the long term, you're much worse off because it's consuming all your time, your thought, your energy. Instead, spend some time with your family. It's beautiful out right now. In a lot of the state, go enjoy it. Missing all that part of life is not good for us. So it's important not to get caught in that. And it, just the other thing that may help people is you can't control what, you know, hundreds of millions of voters do, but you can control what you do. And one of the basic principles about managing our mental health is to focus on controlling the things that are actually in our power. So what I suggest to people is if you're going nuts about some ballot initiative you really care about or some candidate, is take some action, you know, work on the campaign, phone people in favor, give out leaflets. Taking actions that when we can is first off, it's good for our democracy for us to participate, but it's good for us individually because then you're not, instead of obsessing about things you can't affect, you're actually doing your part. That feels good, gives you a sense of control. That's good for your mental health.
And perhaps people feel like when they retweet or repost something that falls in line with the campaigns that they're following, that might be taking action.
Yeah, no, so people can get that feeling, you know, some bit of data coming out. I suspect some part of anxiety dissolution, because we are physical creatures, also involves physical action. So you may get more of that, even just, you know, if it's, you know, making a phone call or working at the polls, if you're it's another way to certainly be involved in the election. So that you're moving a little bit, because, you know, that is also part of how our bodies, you know, get rid of anxiety is, you know, our heart starts going a little more, you get greater blood flow, all that sort of thing. And that might help people more than just sitting still and hitting a button.
Right. Professor Humphreys, you know, early in the year, we were introduced to something called the coronavirus. And then we did the doom scrolling when it came to that. And then over the summer, we had record-breaking heat and wildfires and smoke. We also had social justice movements that were happening throughout the country this year. There was a lot that might raise people's anxiety levels heading into the election. How much does all of that sort of setup to where we are now add to this then increased level of anxiety we might be feeling going into Tuesday?
Yeah, so all of that, you know, definitely makes this harder. If you look at, soldiers who have been on the front for a really long time, there's a reason why the military gives people breaks away from that. So they have some point to shed all that stress, relax. And it's remarkable. Sometimes someone who has been stone-faced up on the front will go back and, you know, burst into tears and cry for 3 or 4 hours and say, what is that? That's sort of, you know, an overshoot of the system. Like, we have to relax sometime. We can't be in fight or flight mode 24 hours a day. It's really bad for us. And in California, we kind of have been in that mode, you know, a lot of us all year. I mean, a lot of change, a lot of, you know, the threat of death from fires, even those who aren't, you know, fleeing their homes as people had to do, you know, we see the impact. I can smell it in the air where I am. I know many Californians can. It's also been a nasty election. So there's been a lot of people feeling personally threatened, their own well-being, their family's well-being. So this is really, really tough. It is not good for us, obviously, and we could all use a break. And some part of that will happen when the election is over. Let's hope. But some of it, unfortunately, is going to go on. Fire season is going to go on. You know, I'd love to say coronavirus will be gone very soon. I'm afraid it probably won't be. So it is a pretty demanding time. What do you do in those situations? I mean, at least one of the eternal human things is seek the comfort of others. So to just have someone to talk to, talk about how you're feeling, get some sense of that there are other people in it with you, and there are, everyone is going through this, some sense of being cared about, and also a chance for you to listen to the fears of other people. That's often the best thing we can do to get through really, really prolonged, difficult stresses like what we've gone through this year.
Professor, since so many things in 2020 have become partisan, I imagine stress might be one of those things. Depending on which party you're in right now, you might be feeling it at a greater level.
Yeah, I think everyone is feeling stressed independent of where they stand, because to sound like someone who grew up watching Schoolhouse Rock, you know, I think we are still all Americans. We are more alike than different. But the tenor of this year has really been that there are good people and there are bad people. And so and everyone is facing a fight against evil in this election. And so everybody, I mean, I talk to people all across the spectrum, you know, is susceptible to that sense of, this is not a discussion between Americans. It's between, you know, us and the enemy. And if that's the way it feels, that's just going to, you know, that's a survival threat. And evolution has taught us we need to, you know, prioritize our immediate survival. And, you know, when everyone feels that way, obviously, that creates a rancorous environment, but also just a frightening environment. I mean, lots of people are scared. Some of those fears are obviously rational. I think others of them are not rational. Mm-hmm. There is still a lot of human community left out there, including across the partisan divide.
You've been doing this for a while. This year, 2020, is your office getting more hits, more, you know, people wanting advice, that sort of thing?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of mental health demand this year on everybody who works in my field. And it started even before the election, because the coronavirus has cut people off, you know, a lot of social isolation, a lot of fear, a lot of bereavement. So we had that already. And then you have the fires and then you have this. So among the many people who are working very hard on the front lines, mental health providers are definitely one of them. Yeah.
With just about 30 seconds here and just a week to go before the election, in the coming days, what's a go-to release for people if they're starting to feel overwhelmed?
Turn off the social media and the internet and instead talk to someone who you love or pick up a book or watch a movie and just tune out, take a break. It'll be there when you get back.
Mm-hmm. Go into a fantasy world of whatever they're showing. So
whatever works for you.
Keith Humphreys is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University and is the go-to guy for election anxiety. And we really appreciate you taking time to share your thoughts with us today.
Great to talk. Take care now.
And that is Insight for today. I'm Randall White with producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon. Our digital team, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minotta. Technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer, Antonio Munez. Insight's managing editor, Aram Sarkissian. And Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. As always, thanks for joining us. And we'll be back again here tomorrow morning. Catch you then.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.